O Jesus, our great high priest, make my words ever smaller, that you, the word of life, may be made known to all. In your name I pray. Amen. Please be seated. It's strange, strange times that we find ourselves in as the church. I'd suggest this afternoon that we are now well into the end of a long period where the church, at least in the so-called West, has had a lot of power. There's been a lot of glory. There's been a lot of entitlement. And I am no church historian, but I would suggest that if you kind of look back through history, that's been the case in a lot of places for at least 1900 years. I'd suggest that about 1900 years ago, we might have taken a detour, a wrong detour, where instead of picking up a heavy cross, we chose to pick up a sword. And so here we are at the end of what historians call Christendom, the time when church and power are so aligned to each other. And at the same time, we look around the world and things don't look so good. We see seemingly hopeless climate change reports. We see the deepening exclusion of the other all over the place, in the state, even in the church. We see wars and we see rumors of wars. We see swings from the left to the right, to the left to the right again. Ball of confusion, that's what the world is today. It's a ball of confusion. So I'd suggest that among it all, amongst all the confusion and the decline, I think it's a good decline, we'll get there, of church, and in the messiness of the world, there's one thing that we're called to be. Lovers. Lovers in a dangerous time. We should have done that song today. I think that when we see the exclusion, when we see the decay, we're called actually to cross a line. We're called to cross a line and actually follow Jesus, who's already hanging out with the excluded, the forsaken, the forgotten, the lonely, the lowly, the meek. I think that's what the church is called to do today. Now, I actually think that the terrible things that happened in the last century and a bit earlier, I'm thinking now of World War II and the atrocities, I'm thinking of the residential schools, both of which that church power relationship, as we know, had a really horrible role in. I think that those can serve as a wake-up call to us at all. So the last period of Christendom, I think, actually did something really good. It struggled for a deeper inclusivity. We drew the circle wide. We said, come as you are, like we do every week. All are welcome. And that's deeply, deeply important work. And it's work that continues. Period. I also want to offer a challenge. I would suggest that in this first period of post-Christendom, perhaps like the first period of Christianity way back in the early church, before we picked up that sword, we're not just called to draw the circle wide, which we are, but we're called to jump in real deep. That is, to refuse to pick up a sword and instead to follow Jesus, to pick up that cross of reckless abandon. The Anglican visitor to our community, Bishop Logan, has proclaimed this a year of discipleship. And I said last week that for me, and I hope for us, this is about radical discipleship. And radical really just simply means rooted. Discipleship is one of those weird churchy words that means nothing to so many people, but really just means to follow. a rooted following of the Lord of all creation, the great high priest, Jesus Christ. Our past United Church visitor, Connie, once quipped to me, "You know, we in the church have tried just about everything. Now perhaps we need to try following Jesus." Seeker sensitive hasn't worked, guitars haven't worked, great liturgy hasn't worked. I love all those things, as you know. But they ain't the point. But let's face it, following Jesus is dangerous. It's hard work. Ched Myers, theologian, says radical discipleship is not a slogan, a mobilizing soundbite, a hip brand, or an ironic Twitter handle. And yet, discipleship is unarguably the central theme of the Gospels. To follow Jesus, to radically follow Jesus, to cross that line to the place of brokenness and exclusion and smallness is the overarching theme of the Gospels. Indeed, Mark's path to where we get today, the story of these two brothers, begins, chapter 10, with a call to surrender our heart and hearts, to be like children, to give away all our goods, to be the last in a world where people want to be first. And of course, these brothers hear all of that, and what do? They grasp and they clamor for power. This Messiah is going to overturn the empire, thanks be to God. We better be the second and third in command, or the second and second in command. Faith has a downward discipleship, Ched Myers goes on to say, remains the road rarely taken in the heart of the empire. He says we have yet to truly reckon with Dietrich Bonhoeffer's famous warning, delivered under the shadow of fascism, that cheap grace is grace without discipleship. So today I would suggest, as radical disciples, or as wannabe radical disciples, because I can't claim to wear that Twitter handle, that we need to raise the bar, or we too risk becoming agents of cheap grace. But it's not just about raising the bar and doing things and delving in deep. That would reduce it to something that somehow depends on how good we can do. And actually, I think probably will just make us clamor to do more stuff. As our gospel story of the two brothers clamoring for the places of honor tells us, the path to the reign of God is not power over. It is to become, as Blessed Dorothy Day said, smaller. It's to become that much smaller. I don't usually quote the King James Version, but I love the way it phrases the question of those brothers. "Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatever we shall desire." "Thou shouldest do for us whatever we shall desire." In other words, Jesus, do what I want. Give me every desire of my heart. I want to sit beside you. Not a bad thing to want. But Jesus says, no. The Christian path, though it ain't easy to preach, is actually one of surrendered desire. Now, just to clarify, notice I don't say repressed desire or suppressed desire, but surrendered desire. What does it mean to surrender desire? The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King calls our need to clamor and to grasp the drum major instinct. In his last sermon, 2 months before he was assassinated, he said it's a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be the first. And it's something that runs the whole gamut of our life. King goes on with humility to point out that we, each and every one of us, are like James and John. We all want the glory. We all want the Facebook likes. We all want and feel entitled to sit beside Jesus. I mean, after all, I'm here week after week, month after month, year after year. I do this and that and that. I'm sure they felt they wanted it. Or perhaps we're like those other disciples. We think we know better. We're the radical disciple ones who have the Twitter handle. How dare they show such entitlement? We live in intentional community and we follow a rule of life. But in that way, we become like those clamoring disciples too. We want to point the fingers that we get it right. And so it is that the cycle goes on and on and on. A ball of confusion, that's what the world is today. I love it when I get to quote 80s songs in a sermon. We need to realize that our sense of entitlement to any of these things, to clamor for power, leads to a world where few have much, where we become consumers instead of humans, where religion becomes about power over, being right over the wrong, and where we find ourselves in a persistent culture war which swings from pole to pole to pole. And so in response to that kind of confusion, Jesus asks those clamoring brothers, and I think he asks us, are you sure that you want to drink from the cup that all drink? Do you want to be baptized as I'm baptized? Those of us who follow the story to its logical end or seeming end know that that story goes on to tell us that that baptism is a baptism of bitter tears. And that cup, it's a cup of blood. We are called to leave the path of chasing power, privilege, and following every whim of desire. And I think a great alternative to delve into the spacious economy of deep, liberating surrender. So yeah, the words are hard to preach. It's not a popular sermon. But the Christian path is not about having what we want. It's about having love. It's about devotion. It's about surrender of the self and privilege for the beauty and good of the world, which ultimately, as the story ends in Hebrews today, is what Jesus did at the cross. No, the Christian path is not that of the colonizer, the capitalist, or the hedonist. It's not the path of the consumer, be that one who consumes the earth or bodies or stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. We are people who recognize the beautiful blessedness of stuff, of the earth, of our bodies, our sexualities, of food, of bread, and of wine, and of water. But I'd suggest today that the second that our recognition of that beauty crosses over into grasping, it's the second that we let our unbridled desire move from a recognition of beauty into a path of destruction and desolation. So instead, I think it's a radical path to which we're called. Our path, the Jesus path, is the one of letting go, of following Jesus, who though he was God, as we quoted a few weeks ago in Philippians, didn't exploit that. And in his weakness and in his surrender of privilege and in his solidarity with all of his creation, became the great high priest, the servant king for us all. So that image of the great high priest, which I think Catherine brilliantly started us on last week, that image of the rope around the priest who, you know, is kind of the sucker who has to go into the Holy of Holies and might melt or something like that, or faint be or die because they're in the presence of God. It's not actually a great job unto itself. But I think that the brilliance of that image of the priest, which we pick up on today, is that it is one of glory, but as Liz so brilliantly pointed out in the children's time, it's on its head. The glory is on its head. This is a priesthood of non-glory. It's a priesthood of lowliness. Jesus did not glorify himself, Paul tells us. The priesthood is a way of non-entitlement. Listen to the words that Paul uses about this great high priest. Chosen, called, appointed, begotten, not inherited, not won by war, not won by fights in the church, not claimed, not entitled, but called. I'd suggest then that we too walk as followers in the way of the great high priest Jesus. We too just have to recognize our called, chosen, appointed begottenness. This great high priest, Jesus, Paul goes on and uses brilliant words. This does not sound like the king of empire. What does this great high priest do? They deal gently. They sacrifice. They offer cries and tears. They lament. They reverently submit and they exhibit obedience through suffering. How's that for power on its head? And so here's the thing. I think that if we actually risked walking that way, that difficult way, that hard way, oppression would cease. The earth, God's people, and God's beloved creation would thrive, and all would have enough if Jesus' followers actually, well, followed. If we just followed. But of course, we know that to live in such a way wars against everything. It wars against everything that we are conditioned to believe that we are and that we deserve. It wars against our sense that we should have the good stuff of life, that we should have the privilege and comfort in the culture, in the church, and in our homes, that we too should get to sit at God's right and left hand rather than sit as eager learners at God's feet. Living in submission to the great high priest, we are not promised comfort. But I think we're promised something so much greater, so much deeper. Lana Lewandowski released a song this week, and it has this great line in it. Now is the time for divine obedience. I think she's right. In a world, in a ball of confusion, now is the time for divine obedience, to respond with gentleness, sacrifice, lament, and even to submit. Now is the time for divine obedience to a different way, a way that defies all logic, a downward way. So yeah, we are all priests, the Protestants tell us. There's a few Lutherans here, so I better be careful. We are all priests. And we live into a priesthood of liberation. We're not entitled to it. We simply accept the call, and by the grace of God, we live it. And in accepting that call, I believe that you and I, each and every one of us, are called to bear the scars of death and empire on our bodies, just as Jesus did. You and I are indeed called to divine obedience. Which actually is good news, even though it doesn't sound like it. It's good news because I actually think this is the most amazing time to be church. This is the time to shed off the scales of millennia of clamoring, of grasping for power, and to find our place across that line with the small and the brokenhearted, which I think is where the church does best and is actually the church. What an incredible call to offer ourselves in divine obedience for the life of the world. So then, today, my fellow priests, glad the bishop isn't here, my fellow priests, my fellow lovers in a dangerous time, may we all pick up the cup of that great high priest and humbly follow him in our own baptisms in his baptism. I will not lie. It's not going to be glorious and triumphal, but it is beautiful. It's like the sun coming in from a stained glass window on a fall afternoon. The paradox in that surrender is that we find unspeakable wonder, beauty, awe, and glory. And in following our great high priest, Jesus Christ, to the cross, we are ultimately called. We are called into life eternal. May we follow. May we cross that line. May we be the brokenhearted, the smaller, the ones who don't clamor, who pick up a cross instead of a sword. And may we do so in the name of our great high priest, Jesus Christ.